Welcome to a podcast from the Irish Linen Centre and Lisburn Museum. Today we are speaking with Dr. James O'Neill on the myths of the 9 Years' War.
We're delighted to have you here in the museum today. Jim O'Neill, heritage consultant, museum professional.
Apparently these days.
Historian of 16th century Ireland. And you've got a fantastic book out, The 9 Years' War. I suppose what we're going to ask you is, can you tell us briefly about the 9 Years' War and why it matters?
Well, the first thing I can tell you is it's called the 9 Years' War, but it lasted 10 years. And that's not my fault. That's a guy, Stanley Sugarity, in the 19th century, says this started in 1594. Didn't actually start in 1594.
Can I point out that I was sitting reading your book, and my 10-year-old son says, "What are you reading, Dad?" I says, "It's a book on the 9 Years' War." And he said to me, "But it's 10 years in the front," because he noticed from the front cover. And I went, "Oh, yeah." I didn't quite notice that, you know.
Everyone says that. It's not my fault. I'm sorry. I'm not the person to go, "Excuse me, lads. We're all calling it the 10 Years' War, right?" It's the 9 Years' War, and that's the way it is. The 9 Years' War, boiled down to it, is ultimately, after years of Tudor reconquest, where you were impinging on the noble rights and privileges of the Irish lords, finally resistance coalesces under the leadership of Hugh O'Neill, Earl of Tyrone. And what happens in 1583 is he actually starts to put together an unprecedented confederation of Irish lords and modernizes the Irish military at the same time. So not only does he create something that really hadn't been seen before, like this, like Native Irish society is almost famous for how fractured it was and parochial, he actually managed to move past that and creates a modernized army, but modernized very much along Irish lines, and then basically moves against English power in Ireland, and over the course of 7 years actually goes from largely English control across Ireland to pretty much the English only have control of the large towns, and they very much think that their power is about to get snuffed out. But then, because this is Irish history, in the last 3 years he actually finds his match, in this case, with a guy called Mountjoy, an English viceroy, who over 3 years rolls those advances back, and then they have this almost climactic battle at Conseil, where O'Neill's overthrown, and then descends into this hideous period of massacre and famine, and that lasts about another year and a half. Then in 1603, O'Neill finally submits in the Treaty of Melfort. The crazy thing as well is that he submits, and Elizabeth is now dead at this stage, Queen Elizabeth, and he gets no harm, no foul. Everything's almost back to the way it was, as if nothing really happened.
Yeah, it's incredible. I mean, O'Neill looms large, obviously, in this story as a main protagonist, but this is not a biography of O'Neill. I mean, you're obviously looking at military, agriculture, economy, these things, but I mean, are you able to talk a wee bit about O'Neill? And I mean, at times he seems to be running rings around them. He's thinking, he's forward thinking, he's strategic, he's thinking several moves ahead. I mean, he seems like a pretty remarkable character, if nothing else.
He is remarkable in that, one, he creates something that hadn't been seen before in Ireland. Two, he moves beyond a very parochial way of thinking. And three, he actually decides that one person cannot do this alone. This is often, occasionally this war is also known as Tyrone's Rebellion, which I don't like using that term for any number of reasons. Mostly because there's Maguires, there's O'Donnells, there's the O'Byrnes, these are the O'Moores and everyone else that was involved in it. So it's not just Tyrone, it's just not the O'Neill show, it's McDonald's as well. It's not just an Irish show, there's also a huge Scottish element there as well. But what he does is he takes this and he creates something really quite new. Not just, and everyone loves talking about, well, he brings guns, but actually didn't bring guns. Guns were around for years, decades before that. But what he does, he brings a new way of using them, and not English. That's where, for years, I was thought there's just something not right about this narrative. The old narrative used to be, I remember Cyril Falls, back in the 1950s, wrote Elizabeth's Irish Wars, and it's like, this just doesn't ring true. But what actually happened? And a lot of it was like, well, the Irish copied the English because the English were actually more modern. But what eventually the evidence showed is that actually he takes sort of military transformations that were happening on the continent and brings it to Ireland, but creates this hybrid, this system that takes the best of the European advances with gunpowder warfare and matches it with the advantages of Irish Warfare, flexibility, speed. And what happens is actually the reverse of what's false had believed, that where he says he copied the English. What happens? I was saying that Mountjoy eventually defeats him. Mountjoy actually copies the Irish reforms and transforms the English army in Ireland to copy those reforms. So it's the total reverse of what we've been seeing before. But it's not just tactics, it's not just technology, because technology never does it on its own. He actually changed a whole operational way of thinking, that whereas before you saw people would look at the battles and go, well, that's progress. O'Neill didn't see it that way. O'Neill didn't see the epitome of conflict as battle. He saw, to paraphrase it, the Duke of Alba has a great term. He says, war isn't about glory, or war isn't about victories. War is about winning. And so when you were looking for Tyrone's advances, it wasn't necessary where the shooting was. Sometimes shooting was actually just merely a distraction.
Mm-hmm.
And it was political and economic advances elsewhere in Ireland that the English can't really get their head around for about 7 years. And that's why you see defeat after defeat after defeat of the English. They realized that O'Neill, before the Irish went to war against the English in different parts of the country, that was only there. It was only in Connacht, or it was only in Leinster, or only in the part of Ulster, say Hugh O'Neill. What O'Neill could do was O'Neill could get something to happen in Wicklow that would affect something in Connacht, that would allow something to happen in Ulster. This operational coordination across the
country. It's incredible, his grasp on the network that he seems to foster to get this.
And the English couldn't get their head around it. There were people like Russell and all just could not get their... And Norris, John Norris was like, everyone was all heard about Drake and Raleigh and all the rest of that. That's because they lived. John Norris was at the time this great military hero from fighting the Elizabethan Wars in the Low Countries. Just as famous as Drake and Raleigh and all the rest of that. But his candle gets snuffed out in Ireland, so no one ever knows about him.
Mm-hmm.
But even he gets just taken for an absolute ride. And only after the fact, when he gets, there's that sort of like displacement operations in 1597, that then he has to look back and go, we just got took for mugs there.
Yeah.
And it was all about operational sophistication. And it's only when Mountjoy comes along that he goes, hold on a sec here.
And he seems to bring a similar level of sophistication and understanding of the chess-like nature of Ireland as a map, that he seems to be able to start creating advances against O'Neill. That's what appears to me as the lay reader. You know,
absolutely right. What he sees, again, war isn't about fighting, it's about winning.
Yeah.
And so whereas people are going, attack O'Neill in Ulster, or attack O'Neill in Munster, which that's Essex in 1599, he gets absolutely smoked.
Yeah.
It's a historical term.
Smoked.
Whereas Mountjoy goes, right, I need to reform the army. I need to realize that these people aren't the Irish of old. This is not just snuffing out fires. This is a much more difficult challenge. And then he sees and identifies Irish weakness, and he goes for it. And so the first thing he does isn't attacking the north, or isn't attacking the south. He actually attacks through the center and cuts supply lines, because that's the old thing. Amateurs talk about battles, it's professionals talk about logistics.
Mm-hmm.
He knew that by cutting supply lines, all of a sudden, and that's exactly what happened, cut supply lines in the Midlands, the whole southern allies basically are starved of supplies. They're forced to fight in a way that hadn't been trained. Carew, who's another man of some skill, would be understating it. Sir George Carew came in and became president of Munster.
Mm-hmm.
He came over at the same time as Mountjoy. And he manages to pacify Munster in the space of a year, but no one else had, even Essex had wandered through Munster with a huge army and did nothing of consequence. Mm-hmm. Whereas Carew managed it in a year with less than a quarter of the troops at hand.
Just better tactics.
Yeah. Thinking ahead, thinking about not fighting, thinking about divide and conquer, thinking about ploys and stratagems that would, like at one point, there's a great episode where he tried to capture basically one of the chief Irish lords in Munster was James Fitzthomas, the Sugar and Earl of Desmond. And rather than campaign against him, he wanted him. Curry wanted him. And he was quite happy to split up his army across all of Munster, just to act as a diversion, to force Desmond to do the same, to leave Desmond vulnerable to betrayal.
Mm-hmm.
Just to that, he set up this complicated plan where he'd pay off one of Tyrone's captains. He got his wife to actually turn him. Just the chance to try and capture him, because he knew he captured him as the figurehead in Munster, everything else would wither. And it almost, it almost worked.
It's incredible chess playing. Like, it's unbelievable. I mean, like, I can see, once you're in it, what would capture your imagination about this period. But what got you into looking at this? I mean, because it wouldn't be perhaps the obvious choice for someone that might think of maybe something more recent, or something, the bigger battle or outcome at the end. But what drew you to this period?
Believe it or not, if someone asked me this, it actually went all the way back to, remember, I was in third year history in St. Mary's on the Glen Road in Belfast. And I remember we did the 9 Years' War, and the history teacher's going through it, and it was all about win, the Yellow Four and all that. And then it goes, stop, lose. And it's like, what happened there?
Yeah.
The narrative just didn't seem right.
Why the switch, yeah.
But of course, that was in third year history. My dad thought I could do engineering. He was very wrong. and I forgot about all that. And then I went through a convoluted career in archaeology and all the rest of that. Then we were doing putting together a battlefield database for Historic Environment Division.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got this long list of about 300 sites across Northern Ireland that may have potential battlefield archaeology. And we, in 2003, me and a colleague, just got the chance to do a battlefield metal detecting test survey, just to see how can you identify those sites,
mm-hmm.
what would the archaeology look like, because then we don't hear. And so we looked at a long list of sites and went, the Yellow Ford, that will do for us. Because the things like Ben Burb from 1646 and all, they'd all been found. Yellow Ford was still a bit amorphous, a bit. Mm-hmm. This is O'Neill's greatest victory in 1598. And so we went and did all the research around that,
mm-hmm.
And did the metal detecting survey and found bits and pieces and used landscape analysis and all the rest of that to find out. So we're now considering all bits of shot and things that we found and dispersion of where they are. I went, all right, that looks where it is. But just in doing all that research, I went, oh, this whole 9 Years' War thing, no one's really looked at it.
Mm-hmm.
And I can even remember, this is in 2000. I was one of those late comers to university, you know, get to about 2000. My girlfriend, my wife, said, you know, you should really do a degree. And I thought, okay, I'll do a degree.
Mm-hmm.
But I was working at the time, so we did part time. So 7 years of undergrad. I did quite well. And I can still almost embarrassed. I remember going in this, overly effusive, just graduated undergraduate. And I went into Peter Gray. Who's head of history in Queens. I remember actually he was waving John Child's book, The Wedgemite Wars in Ireland, big brick of things, fantastic book. And I was waving that at him and I was going, why is this has to be done in Leicester? It was Leeds or Leicester or something like that. And why is that done? Why can this not be done here? And I remember him saying, well, what are you going to do about it? Challenge accepted.
Then you knew you were in trouble.
And then I'm done for it. I just sort of set myself up to get... And so... I had actually graduated quite well. I came out first of the class in history and I thought, well, I'm only a star for one shining moment.
Mm-hmm.
And so I applied for the PhD program and then in the way Queen's Works, you have to do a master's and then a PhD. So did the master's. A large section of that was on the SLL, the 9 Years' War. Large element of my undergrad was on the 9 Years' War. And so just followed in, did and put through the proposal for, I think we ended up, the title was The Military Revolution and the 9 Years' War now. Yeah.
That's interesting. It wouldn't be your, I mean, not many people would have the chance to look at the archaeology first and then take the PhD project after it. Some might come from looking at secondary sources or inspired by a bit of reading or something and then think of a project. And then at the end of it might end up on the battlefield doing a bit of archaeology. But you got to do it almost about turn.
Oh, yeah. We got to look at it on the ground.
That's cool.
Literally, you know the landscape. You can see what's happening.
Yeah.
And so when you start out, once you already know the ground, and to be fair, Yellow Ford is one of my favourites. Moray Pass is brilliant. The Moray Pass is down by Jonesburg. It's something else. Because it's all, so the landscape hasn't changed that much. Mm. And certainly the topography hasn't changed. Mm-hmm. So once you know that, and you're imagine that all of a sudden when you're starting to push together the things that are on documents, your understanding of the documents and the way you see them happening becomes a lot easier to understand. Maybe yeah. come up with ideas that maybe weren't so
you have an advantage obvious. Almost because yeah. you've been because yeah.
you've been there. You might think of it slightly different.
Yeah, that's great, isn't it?
One of the examples I remember for years ago, people always used to write about the Moray Pass battle. This was in 1600, and it was a book on battlefields. It was done by someone in England, and they just looked at the accounts, and it says, "Oh yes, and Mountjoy says he penetrated a mile into the battle and no into the pass." Then fought, and then of course not. And then this got repeated the whole very time. Mm-hmm. But when you go down to the pass, it only is about 200 yards long. You can't go yeah, line can't go the pass, because yeah, if you're yeah. going to a mine, you're away on past yeah. the constructed ground.
Mm-hmm.
So just straight away, you know it. And then even it's another one where your understanding of the ground totally changes the way you think about it.
Like, mm-hmm.
What they never would have got, but only when you see it, is that one of the obvious things is it says, oh, well, the English can deploy artillery. And the Irish didn't have artillery. Well, the Irish did have artillery, they just hadn't any use for it.
Mm-hmm.
They captured loads of English artillery and never deployed it. But when you go to the Moray Pass, straight away you go, reverse slope defensive position.
Okay.
They know everyone, we'll not talk about the film Waterloo, but in the Battle of Waterloo, you have Wellington places his troops on the reverse slope
mm-hmm.
to protect from the artillery. You go to the Moray Pass, and this is what? 200 years before Waterloo, more than 200 years,
mm-hmm.
and he's got his position set up on a reverse slope.
Okay. A natural reverse slope, yeah.
A natural reverse yeah. slope. Because, and if you actually try to deploy artillery against the defences,
mm-hmm.
the first time you can actually see the defences is within when you're within firearm range.
Right, okay.
So you can't, so and that's just obvious only when you're looking at it on
yeah.
the ground.
Yeah. So that's an incredible advantage in a way that you have that understanding of the topography and
oh yeah,
you'd read the battle, yeah.
And an archaeologist love of maps is really probably unhealthy.
Yeah. So we're obviously in the Lagan Valley. Today's Lagan Valley, we're interested in it. And we think of obvious sites like Carrickfergus or Inislochlin, which features mm-hmm. in your book. I mean, so what sort of opportunities for like battlefield tourism are there around? And I mean, if you were to give us a list of a site or two that we could go out on a weekend and look at. I mean, is that putting you under too much pressure? Is it?
Well, I always love it. I'm a sucker for Yellow Ford. Yellow Ford is
yeah, okay.
It's down just north of Blackwater Town. The Moray Pass, we already said, I'll not stress the issue now. Carrickfergus, the thing about over here is that it doesn't come up too much because it was so secured by O'Neill very
mm-hmm.
early on.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the fighting all happens either down in Armagh.
Mm-hmm.
You get a lot of places that pop up that maybe aren't not necessarily fighting, but places like Strangford and all.
Mm-hmm.
And so, well, how does Strangford come up? And so there's an account of O'Neill uses a supply depot, and there's a point that I think said there's only 20 or 30 Scottish ships all mirrored at the one time.
He's getting supplies in from Scotland, yeah.
That's a lot of time. That's one of the things also I love about this, where the Scots, as we all know, there's a certain occasionally antagonism, but in this case it's totally the opposite. O'Neill is actually allied to James MacDonald in Dunluce. Most of his gunpowder and most of his military supplies is coming from Glasgow,
mm-hmm.
bought and paid for. Mm-hmm. None of that, and it's not any of this we'll trade up for like tides or nothing. This is bought with cashy money.
Mm-hmm.
And it is all done. In fact, this war probably couldn't have happened if it hadn't been for the acquiescence of James VI in Scotland,
mm-hmm.
who turns a massive blind eye.
Mm-hmm.
Elizabeth's ambassador in Scotland, like, are you seeing what's going on here? There's like shipments of arms. They're coming in basically one side of Scotland, all from the Europe, and
mm-hmm.
even as far away as Danzig in the Baltic.
Wow.
And they're coming to Scotland, middlemen, then going out in Glasgow, and they're landing all along Strangford and on the north coast.
And what's the reason for this? What's his the motivation for being allied to O'Neill?
For the Scots, the same reason, because they'd already, for the MacDonalds, they got a very hard time mm-hmm. From Essex in the 1570s, you know, the whole enterprise of Ulster.
Okay.
And the massacres of Rathlin, that's the sort of lack of protections that the Irish had applied to the Scots as right. well.
Okay.
That's where the whole thing is, well, is this a rebellion? It's like, well, they're not subjects. Well, she said they're subjects. Well, she could say they're subjects, but didn't treat them like subjects.
Mm-hmm.
They had no protection of law.
Okay.
Subjects have a protection of law. Like, you couldn't the kind of thing like the Enterprise of Ulster, really just essentially a private land grab covered by English law. You would never, that would never happen in Northumberland. It would never happen in Wales, but it did here.
Yeah,
so okay. You can't call them subjects and not treat them like subjects.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we can call it a rebellion. But with the Scots, right from the start, right from 1593, they were having stockpiles of munitions on the north coast and then bringing them down to Dungannon and then bringing on to places like down near Margaret Hill, Moyruck, and all those locks with cramages on there.
Mm-hmm.
And they were used to store stockpiles and of munitions and equipment. And even the names of most of the officers that are named at Dye and Conceal, or a lot of them are MacDonald.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not talking about the, that actually said later, we're not talking about the like Harry Highlander sort of guys in kilts type thing. These are like Renaissance soldiers, you know, with arms and equipment and guns experience and gunpowder, not running around with shields and waving swords.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, those did exist. They were called Red Shanks, but there was a problem very early in the war with the Clanny and Moore, MacDonald, and that all dried up.
Yeah, okay.
There were very, and all the idea of, you know, the Gallow glass with their axes, now, it's not there.
Yeah.
At the very, very start, it is, but very, very quickly, all you see is shot and pike and swordsmen, all used in a very Renaissance style.
Mm-hmm.
This romantic image, it's all gone.
Yeah, okay.
Which is possibly actually one of the reasons why no one's ever heard of it.
Right.
Because if you actually consider, as we all know, there can be two narratives in Northern Ireland sometimes.
Yeah.
And for one, O'Neill doesn't fit because no one likes the modern Gael. Certainly in one tradition, they like older, sort of like the classic Cú Chulainn type Gael.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Gael I like. And the modern Gael also doesn't fit with another because it's not the primitive Gael needing to be reformed.
Mm-hmm.
This is like, it doesn't fit anyone's standard.
And O'Neill wasn't anti-monarchy. Like he was happy if like Philip II from Spain came in. Was,
oh yeah, yeah. This isn't some sort of, he makes a very poor nationalist hero.
Yeah.
Because he didn't want any of that.
Yeah.
This wasn't for freedom from England. This was just swapping one sovereign for another.
Yeah.
Because he didn't want to be king.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he couldn't get away with that because his station didn't allow, no, there were other lords of equal standing, and there's no way the MacDonalds are going to stand for it.
Yeah.
And there's no way the O'Byrnes would stand for it. The Sullivans, they're not going to have that at all. This was just essentially swapping one sovereign for another. Yeah.
It's a complex character, O'Neill. Like,
oh, God. Yeah. It's... He certainly, they always say, oh, well, was he some sort of Catholic crusader type? He wasn't at all. One of the best lines is that Essex, and I'm not a fan of the Earl of Essex, not by anything, a long stretch, and one of the best lines that ever comes up, they have this great meeting in the river in 1589, and he says, I'm paraphrasing here, but Essex says, but why did you start all this? And O'Neill comes up with this grandstanding thing, but this is for religion. This is for the rights of our faith.
Mm-hmm.
And Essex sort of goes, are you kidding me? You care for religion about as much as my horse does. and Essex wasn't wrong.
Yeah, okay, well. Okay, we have about 5 minutes left before you to give a talk. So I know James had a question, a burning question for Jim here.
Jim, you know, there's obviously some very big names associated with the 9 Years' War, perhaps none more so than O'Neill himself. On the crown, we have Mountjoy, Essex. But there's also many officers involved in fighting on the side of the crown who are lesser known figures, often the younger son of a landed family. In particular, locally, we have Sir Fulk Conway and Sir Moises Hill, who subsequently are granted lands in Lisburn, modern day Lisburn and Hillsborough, respectively. So it'd just be interesting to know. What opportunities did the war provide for such individuals? You know, did it sort of set them up with a career and a future after war, considering that they, in all likelihood, wouldn't have got estates, considering that they were a younger son of a family?
It could, if you lived. That was the problem. Moses Hill, always a favourite of mine. He was up in Carrickfergus for a good while. Actually gets allegations that he sold Older Fleet Castle to the Scots for a few quid.
Okay.
say nothing. But yeah, you could get set up, but it was a very risky promise that certainly by the time you get in 1599 and 1600, mm-hmm. you're going, really? Is this how you get rich? Because mostly you just got dead.
Okay.
You could get very rich. And certainly when you have places like the Munster Plantation, 1585 and all the rest of that, seems like a very good place to come and get some easy land. It ends bad for the Munster Plantation. There must be easier ways to earn money than coming here. And certainly by 1600, you would have been looking and thinking, have I made a mistake here? Actually, earlier than that, you might have been looking, have I made a mistake?
Because
that's one of the things that perhaps, it's hard to express how close this war was. I came across so many people who were ultimately, the Irish couldn't have won. I was like, well, actually, they almost very, very nearly did. And yet they actually find someone pinned down another war where everything boiled down to this bond pinprick balance that I conceal. That if you win everything. And if you lose everything. And Mountjoy said that. Mountjoy said, if we win here, all Ireland is ours. If he wins here, all Ireland is his. That's how close it was.
I think I read that you accused us.
Possibly accused.
You suggested that O'Neill didn't use the best tactics at Kinsale, like tactics that weren't naturally his.
Oh, yeah. I have very good friends, Damien Shields and Harry Morgan, who are probably the best people I know to talk to about Kinsale. And we've been on the ground in Kinsale. And we think, why did he do that?
Yeah.
Why did he do that? Why did he deploy troops in that formation he'd never deployed in? And using the type of equipment, like those big tertio type formations they deployed, they need at least half of them to have pegs to work. And O'Neill never had that many pegs. In fact, his tactics depended on not having pegs like that. But did he deploy it like that way? There's burning questions we can't have answered because we don't have them. Remember, it was Damien Shields said, how does O'Donnell get lost in a march over a mile at night when he can march 40 miles over the Steve Fell Mountains and not get lost? There's huge amounts of unanswered questions that I can seal
a week. A lot of what-if history there.
The counterfactual history is one of those ones that's best kept for the public. We still can't figure it out and we still can't agree.
Yeah, okay. Last question, I'm going to rush this a wee bit because of your talk. We all work in museums here, we're interested in museum collections. Is there somewhere, where's the best place to go and look at objects, items relating to the 9 Years' War? Where can you get immersed?
There's only one place for that. That's around Ferley House out in Dungannon.
Okay.
Yeah. That's where you want to go.
Mm-hmm.
They're working on renovating their exhibit down there. They have some excellent material, some excellent tour guides there. But more importantly, the Hill of O'Neill is the Hill of O'Neill. You can't see the castle now. The castle's underground. But if you go up to the top of that hill, you can see what O'Neill could see. And on a clear day, you can see most of Ulster. You can see Slemish from there. You can see the Cooley Mountains in there.
Yeah.
You can see all the way down the Clogher Valley. And then, of course, you're quite near Tullahoge. Homes of my ancestors.
Okay.
If you go from there on Tullahoge, that's the place you gotta go.
Yeah.
Okay. And then of course you're not too even from the whole name, you can actually see the Yellow Fort battle site.
Wow, okay.
You know, it's the place to go.
So what I'm hearing is visit Lisburn Museum and then go to Runferley House.
Visit Lisburn Museum because it's awesome, the people there are great. And then go out and see all the good folks at Runferley House at Hill O'Neill. I'll see you right.
Brilliant. Thanks a million for your time today.
No worries.
It's been brilliant listening to you. And we'll go hear your talk.